I'm Mark Hennick. This is So-Called Normal. Hey folks, welcome to So-Called Normal. I'm Mark Hennick. Today, my guest on the show is Erwin Ellman. Erwin is the former provincial advocate for children and youth for the province of Ontario, a position which he held for about a decade. And he is one of the most powerful advocates for children that I've ever encountered. I've been following his work for quite a few years now. And I was so grateful to be able to have a conversation with him about the state of child and youth care in the province of Ontario, yes, but really across Canada and around the world, how we treat kids and how we look after them, how we take care of them. And most importantly, what Sean threw for me in his interview was how we honor their voice, how we amplify their voice to really change the system. And he's been such a great champion for children and youth in that respect. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with the incredible Erwin Ellman on So-Called Normal.
These days, I would start with I'm a parent of two young boys. I have a son that's 11 and a son that's 15. They've become the center of my thoughts since I left being the child advocate for the province. And so I think when people hear politicians, and wouldn't say I was a politician, but in a political job, when people hear politicians say they're going to retire and spend time with their family and their children, I used to be cynical about that. It's true.
Yeah, I
can feel that.
Yeah.
But I think it's important for people to know that I try and model what I say. And I like that saying by J.S. Wordsworth that we should all take our place in the world's work and the world's struggles. And so I continue to do that, and I continue to find routes to do that.
So you were the child advocate for the province of Ontario for quite a long time, right?
Yep, almost 11 years.
11 years. Yeah. So can you talk to us about that role? What was that? What was your job? What were you doing?
Well, the legislature passed unanimously a piece of legislation that created an independent child advocate's office. And the legislation said that the office was to partner with children and youth to bring their issues forward and make sure they're heard. In my mind, make sure they weren't invisible. We had a range of advocacy services that we had to deliver, individual advocacy, systemic advocacy. And late after the legislation was passed, maybe 10 years later, they granted the office investigation powers into child welfare. So I was the first child advocate for the province. So the legislation was passed and they had to find an independent officer of the legislature. And I was 2007 hired as the child advocate through a all-party committee unanimously and passed, had to go to vote in the legislature. And the legislation said that the child advocate could have a second five-year term, again, if the legislature thought it was warranted and supported the advocate. So after my first 5 years, they did reappoint me for another five. That was the last term I could have. The legislation said only two terms for any child advocate. And my term ended in November, but in October, our government decided that, well, they weren't going to replace me. They were just going to repeal the act and get rid of the child advocate. And so I stayed on a little longer, both to say what I thought and what I thought children and young people would think about that move, and then to stay once the legislation was passed to sort of protect as best I can the rights of children moving forward and my staff.
So did you do a very good job and children no longer need advocacy? Or what was the...
I wish I could say we did that good a job.
Right.
You know what I think? I think at, to one way of thinking about it was that we did such a good job that this government in some ways, you know, thought, why would we be paying several million dollars to this office of the legislature to criticize what we were about to do.
Right.
And I'm not saying that was the only reason why the government did what they did. I can't help but think it was part of the reason. And I say that because the model our office developed in terms of child advocacy has been replicated as the first child advocate system in Japan. We had in Ukraine. We've had our work modeled in Nova Scotia. We're now the only province in the country without an independent child advocate. Mm. So I've never been given a reason about why that was done. So
I think it's a reasonable.
Our effectiveness was one of the reasons.
Sure. To critique government. And actually, I've seen this for years in the mental health system specifically, in which the funder doesn't, or the funded rather, don't want to bite the hand that feeds them. And therefore, we have a mental health system that is fundamentally broken at the government level.
Yes.
But groups that are tasked with advocacy won't advocate effectively because they don't want to lose the money.
Well, that's true. And we've seen that literally, right? When we had a minister who's now, I think she calls herself the Minister of Cheers. When she was the minister in charge of mental health and special needs, she actually told services that if you don't publicly support what we're doing, for instance, around autism, it's going to be a really tough 4 years. And they were just in the beginning of their mandate. And frankly, the service providers did not support, but they certainly decided to be quiet. And there is a chill. Mm. And it's not just a chill in terms of speaking out about what's happening, but I believe it's a chill in allowing services to work together, because even this idea of assembling together, they worry that the ministries or the government will see that as some kind of affront to what they're doing.
Right.
And it's problematic.
Right. So what happens now? I mean, who's going to stand up for the kids that you were standing up for?
Well, there's a gap. There's no formal child advocate in the province, but my experience is, and this is me being hopeful, my experience is that there are thousands of what I'd call informal child advocates in this province. I'm sitting across the table from one, in my opinion.
Sure.
And it's going to be up to those informal child advocates and Ontario to step up and step up for young people and partner with young people to move their voice forward, allow them to be heard. I've seen progress made in terms of creating space for young people. In fact, I think the next advocate after me, remember I was on my second and last term, had an opportunity to really harness the voice of young people and sometimes the most marginalized young people, because they were organizing.
Right.
They wanted a place at the table. And there was going to be the ability to have such a rich partnership. Mm-hmm. But from my point of view, there's a saying the young people, the thousands of young people we work with say is not stopping here. And I think that's true.
Yeah.
They don't intend to stop here.
So,
but it's up to adults and informal advocates to support them in using their voice.
Yeah, you know, I think that's been my experience both as a young person trying to have my voice heard at the time. I'm increasingly or decreasingly young every day.
Young
I'm reminded. Well,
my
gray hair count is steadily increasing. But but I think that to a degree, you have to have pointy elbows, right? To elbow your way into the table.
You do.
But if that table, if there's a wall around that table that you can't even get near it in the first place, then it's difficult. And that's where we can tear down that wall.
I think that was what our office provided children and young people of all sorts, was access and resources. And they had the voice. They have the knowledge. They have the wisdom that comes from their lived experience that can create change by people rallying around them, by calling the emperor with no clothes. They can do that. They just needed the access to those tables. And we had the positional authority, the child advocate has the positional authority to create that access and opportunity. And I have not met young people who don't want that opportunity. That's one of the learnings I had over the 11 years, was that almost anywhere I went, and I'd be curious how you felt back when you were a teen, but I've met kids in stairwells, you know, who left child welfare and their home after they left child welfare was a stairwell. I've met kids in shelters. I've met young people in mental health institutions. And to a person, they were struggling with their own stuff, but they often talked about not wanting things to be the same for those who came after them.
Yeah.
And they would jump on any opportunity, no matter what situation they were in, mm-hmm. to use their lived experience to create change. And I felt, and I've seen, I used to say this to service providers, that when you provide them with that opportunity, it's not only their right, it's not only helpful to this province, what you do too, it's paying a big price that we don't even realize how much work it is to use your lived yeah. experience to create change. But it's helpful, but it's also helpful to them, because right. when they have a voice and when somebody is listening, it's when they, I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but it's when they become fully recognized human beings,
yeah.
because they have some worth and their experience means something yeah. than just pain. And so it's really helpful, and service providers have begun in Ontario, had begun in Ontario, to recognize this. It's in, we helped get it into the Child and Youth Family Service Act about the need and the right to their voice very strongly in the Child and Family Youth Service Act. And so we were at a point just to start implementing that in the province, and a new advocate would have a chance to partner with children to do that. Mm-hmm. But I think now it's going to be up to all those informal advocates mm-hmm. to make sure it happens, because mm-hmm. the law is there.
Unless somebody comes along and organizes.
I used to say it can't happen. They'd have to repeal the Child and Youth Family mm-hmm. Service Act, and I hesitate saying this now just to give them an idea, because I don't think this government is particularly interested
right.
in the voice of those who are on the receiving end of the services, the mm. most marginalized, mm. Certainly young people in the province. They've repealed legislation with a snap of a fingers. But I think there needs to be pushback, and there needs to be some organizing if that ever happened, and there still needs to be a voice of children. Yeah. And when you started this interview by talking about the chill that service providers feel, it's really interesting that there's really no chill when you give young people
right.
a sense of opportunity to use their voice yeah. so they can lead us in that too.
What are some of the stories from kids, from youth, that really stand out in your mind over the last 11 years of your work?
Oh, there's so many. I'm thinking of, you know, all the young people I met, whether collectively, our mandate was young people connected to youth justice system, young people in some way connected to Children's Aid Society systems, mm-hmm. young people connected to mental health, young people connected to special needs. And I have stories from each of those groups of young people. First Nations young people was in our mandate. I'm going to say the one, because I don't say it very often around disabilities and young people with disabilities, but they say the same thing. And this was somebody saying something to me. He couldn't even talk. I remember going to a place called Darling Homes. And as a child advocate, I would spend a lot of time listening to young people. It was my job. So I would go visit places and try and meet with young people. I went to Darling Homes. And from my point of view, Darling Homes was a place where young people who had what they call complex medical needs and who maybe were near the end of their life might go. This was a group of young people I had not worked with before, because before I was the advocate, my career was working with young people and listening to them. And so I went to this place, Darling Homes, and it was kind of institutional, but anybody in the service system knows, I don't know if you felt this, when you walk into a place, even service providers and people in the field talk about, you can feel that it. You know
oh,
if a
God,
place
yeah.
is safe.
Yeah.
When you walk into it, you go, this is it. And people have a very hard time putting their finger on what the it is.
Yeah, you also know when it's unsafe.
Absolutely. Right? You go,
yeah.
ugh.
Yep.
So this is institutional, but it felt like it. And the nurse who met me started taking me around, and we eventually went to a room where there was a 12-year-old boy who couldn't move, couldn't speak, uses his physical voice. She said, I assumed he was not doing well, and she talked to me about him, and I said, how do you communicate with him? And she said that, well, we communicate he can use his tongue some to say yes or no. And, you know, we certainly know when he's unhappy and we know when he's happy mm-hmm. with us, and he lets us know. And she said something like, we communicate in relationship. And I thought, wow, that's something I couldn't do. I didn't know how to do that. Mm-hmm. And how do we elevate the voice of those young people and partner with them? But I noticed something else, because I thought that was my big learning, yeah? And I noticed something else. There was Montreal Canadiens stuff all over his room and bed. And I'm going, I was a Montreal fan back then until they traded P.K. Subban. And then that was racism, and I got rid of them now. Not to mention I jumped on the Leaf bandwagon.
That's a whole other story, yeah.
So he's there. I saw the Montreal Canadiens stuff, and I thought, yeah. How do you know he likes the Montreal Canadiens? And I was like that Columbo-like kind of guy, so I asked her that. She said, again, we communicate in relationship. We can tell, right? Mm. And his parents told us. And I'm going, wow. And I thought on the way home from that place, I thought, wow, me and him are Montreal Canadiens fans. And all that Montreal Canadiens stuff around his bed, whether you liked it or not, you're a Toronto Maple Leaf fan or not listening to this, that was his voice. Mm. That was him saying, I'm a Montreal fan. Mm. And me and him were the same. We were belonging to the same group and the same club. And he now was no longer this 12-year-old who can't talk, can't move, sitting in a bed, I thought, waiting to die. No, he's a Montreal Canadiens fan. Mm. And that made him like me. And I thought, that's what young people with disabilities were telling us when they say, we want to be more than our disabilities. Mm-hmm. We do not want to be an autistic person. Mm-hmm. I don't even think you use that in the political career. A child with autism, we want to be a Montreal fan. We want to be a Starbucks barista. I've met him. We want to be a doctor, whatever. Mm-hmm. We're not our disabilities. We want to be fully human. And he used his voice to do that, even though he couldn't speak. And every group of young people, I have a story for Kids in Care, a story about First Nations young people, a story about Black youth living in the midst of the gun violence. Mm. This whole sense that we want to be people, fully known, fully understood. It's human. Right? It's not rocket science, and that's what young people tell me. Isn't like
you don't need a PhD dissertation.
Right, what are you telling this ridiculous story,
Erwin,
as if it's some like rocket science. It's not rocket science.
No.
The rocket science to me is when that deputy minister, I tell him a story like that or any others, and he says, Warren, I remember it. What do you want me to do about that?
Right.
And I can hear this government saying that. What do you want me to do about that? Because we're going to amalgamate, we're going to save money, but we can't legislate love. Mm. And I know I'm going on this big long rant, but sorry.
But please do.
We can't legislate love, and you've told me to tell that deputy minister, no, you can't legislate love, but you can legislate the conditions in which love can flourish.
Right.
And that's when I think about you. Mm. And I was asking if I could say that, mm-hmm. because I think about the story I read when you were a teen and you're on that bridge and somebody came to you and held you.
Yes.
And there was somebody else saying, go, jump.
Yeah.
And how do we legislate the conditions in which people, systems can put their arms around young people and listen? Because I remember you said, the interview I saw said, the person said, I got you. Mm-hmm. You can talk if you want.
Yeah.
I want to hear you, but you don't have to. Yeah. Whatever. It's your call, but I got you.
And it wasn't
how do systems do that?
Well,
and
that's
we
it.
Can do that.
And he, you know, when that guy pulled me off the bridge, sure, that saved my life, that action of pulling me off of an inch and a half of concrete. But that's not what stopped me from going back the next day.
Right.
Right? What stopped me was this image in my mind of seeing a guy who chose, for whatever reason, to stand on the sidelines and tell me to jump, to shout out for me to jump, and this other guy who chose not to, who chose to have my back, who chose to reach out, who chose to talk to me and get to know me. That's what, I mean, that launched my whole career. That gave me my whole life from there, was that act of how do I be like that guy instead of the guy on the sidelines.
And when we don't, yeah, I agree. And so my thought is, how do we make and support people working in systems in relationship with young people and children and families, how do we make them support them to have the ability to do that? Mm-hmm. There are many who want to. Mm-hmm. There are many who won't, right? Mm-hmm. I get it. It's not every person in the systems that are going to feel that way or do that. But how do we build that? How do we create training in our schools to offer people to do that? How we build systems that work? Because it doesn't matter. This is me, and I don't know what you'll say, but it doesn't matter where that person comes from. It could be a teacher. It could be a child and youth worker. It could be an employer. It could be, I've seen it be a secretary in the services I ran, who was that person that that young person felt was there for them, mm-hmm. that would listen. And then you allow the young person or you to do all the hard work. Mm-hmm. It's not the helper that is doing the work. No. It's the young person, and you have to believe, like that man on the bridge, that he was telling you too, you're worth it, and you can do it.
Yeah, and it's getting,
I know he knew you could do it.
It's getting the system out of the way so that way the person's power can come through.
In many ways. Yeah. And so the law now says, the Child Youth Family Service Act says, every service provided under that act has to be child-centered. Mm. I think even the system's bought in. Mm. But the question is, how do we make that happen? Right. What does that mean? And I think you talk a lot about, not specifically, but what you've talked about is about child-centered practice,
Absolutely.
Child-centered service.
To stop doing services to people.
Exactly.
You know, and I'm firm on this even to this very day, at times if I still struggle, that nobody's going to do recovery to me. You can't insert or inject recovery into me. But I can find that way myself in a circumstance, in an environment that promotes that.
And one of the things I think the services have to do is then believe in you.
Yeah.
Right? Believe that you can.
Well, and this was one of the things I think that kept me most stuck when I was a teenager, you know, because I was a frequent service user by the end or at the end of that period of my life where I had gone through the revolving door so many times that everybody knew me by name. In one of my last, I wrote about this in my book, which isn't out yet. Hopefully it'll be out eventually. But
I look forward to that.
Me too. Me too. But in one of the final discharge notes from that period of my teen years, it said, we're not even going to close Mark's file because he's probably going to be back. So I had been written off. And I think what I'm drawing out of what you're saying is that this categorization of people, of putting them into a box according to the diagnostic criteria or wherever they are, this person with autism or this person with schizophrenia or whatever it is, that immediately blocks out all of those other possibilities. That's the wall that we're trying to break down.
Yeah, right now in terms of you brought up autism, there's this big discussion about needs-based service. Mm. And to me, needs-based service isn't what the government thinks it means, which is, we have this little box of autism service and we'll parse out the money based on what they need. Mm-hmm. To me, needs-based service is every child, you start with the premise, every child, every young person should get what they need when they need it.
Right.
That's it. And then you figure out how to deliver that. Because it's not about what box. It's about looking at what a child needs, listening to what the child says they need, and making sure they have it in a timely way.
And designing the system in such a way that it's not an adult needs based way of meeting child's needs. You know, if you have services that are only available from 9 to 5 Monday to Friday at a Bay Street office,
that's not what they need.
That's not what they need.
That's why listening to children and young people, understanding them, because listening isn't always listening to their voice, but it's intuitively understanding what they need.
Like, and listening to behavior too. Behavior is information. If something isn't working, then why isn't it working?
Going back to that young man at Darling Home, that's what the nurses said. You might think he doesn't talk, but certainly when we do something he doesn't like, we know about it. Make no mistake.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of, it was very influential in my own thought development, reading Henry Nouwen and the idea that people with disabilities in particular teach us more about our own disabilities, our emotional disability, our inability to connect with others around us in that way.
Yeah.
And I think if we were to use the opportunities to interact with people with high need in particular as opportunities to teach us about how we can do better for them, I think that on its own would change the system rather than seeing them as the problem.
Right. And you know, I hesitate to say I read Jean Vanier, but I think about him. I've been to L'Arche, and I think
very similar,
that
yeah.
philosophy that Jean Vanier has, which is about how much we can grow as human beings by working with people with what we call quote-unquote disabilities. And the other thing he talked about, which I think is true about all of us and young people for sure, is this quote that I paraphrase, which is, we think that our greatest need as human beings is to be loved, but actually our greatest need is to belong. Mm. And I've seen that over and over again from First Nations children who are ripped out of their culture and community and sent thousands of kilometers away to a group home and ripped out of their sense of belonging. And then we wonder why they lose hope.
Right.
I've seen it in the kids in care who move from home to home to home to home to home to home to home. That's the average, what I just did. And we wonder why at the end of the day they feel abandoned and hopeless and there's nobody there for them. That's their report, My Real Life Book, what they said. Or black young people in Toronto who are living through this guns and gangs stuff, and you know, we say no to a community center that was supposed to be in their community. We cut equity programs, we cut after school programs, we cut breakfast programs in their communities. We consider and talk about increasing class size in order to build their resilience. That's what the minister said. And then
increasing class size, and then we buy
cameras so we can surveil them more.
Right.
Like, what do we expect in terms of hopefulness for these young people?
Right. How can we figure out which policy decisions are being made actually in the interest of kids versus all this spin or feeble attempts to try to make it seem like a good idea? You know, what's actually happening
here?
Well,
let's talk. Right? Let me talk about that resilience thing
for a sec,
because I thought it was so ridiculous, right? I hope most of people listening to this would have thought, what a stupid thing to say. That was just dumb spin by the minister. Right. And then she doubled down when she was on the media again, saying, give me a second chance. And she doubled down on it, saying, no, it will. So I Googled, and if you Google it, I think her name's Betsy DeVos, which is the Secretary of Education in the States.
United States.
And you can see she's talking about this.
Interesting.
And so, okay, do they really believe this, right?
Right. Well, right. And that's my question. Do they really believe it, or?
I don't know. And because people even say to me, why did they close your office? And I have to say, I don't know. And then they say, well, do you think it was the minister? Because, you know, the minister was very supportive of me and our office in opposition, even as she first became the minister. So maybe she didn't really do it. Maybe. And at this point, I don't know.
Right.
It's really impossible to tell. Well, I'll say this. People might think it's strange coming from me. There's nobody in this government, I believe, because I haven't met any politician, any service provider who wakes up in the morning and says, I want to harm kids. Mm. That's my goal today. I'm going to stick pins in babies' eyes. And sorry, that's a bad analogy, but it's the worst one I could ever think of. And it came from my philosophy. So, they're not waking up.
But then how can they not see the harm they're doing?
They can't see. This is my belief, right? Mm. I knew them in opposition. I knew how thirsty they were for the opportunity to govern. They kept losing election after election that they thought were theirs to win. I'm talking about this Conservative Party and the people who took over. And so I think they're blinded. They were blinded by that. Their belief is that the deficit is a huge thing to solve. Mm. They think their bread is buttered on ensuring that money isn't wasted, and who wouldn't want to waste money? But it seems to me that they built up this animosity and anger while they were in opposition. They carried that baggage into governing, and it's harmed them. It made it look like they want to harm kids. But the complete focus on finances and deficit has had them believe that the agenda for government is to not spend the public's money.
Right.
And that's their agenda.
Sure.
No other agenda.
No, and
that's
I get that.
That's a problem.
But it means then that if... They don't think about it.
And what it means they're doing and what they want to do
this
for people.
It. And it's not even long term. And it means that if they're not evil, then they're stupid. Because if you actually invest in kids, in youth, in upstream interventions, in community development, it saves on the long run anyway. It's better for the economy. Mm. The economic output is better.
Yeah. Misguided.
I shouldn't say stupid.
No, we shouldn't say that. We can think that, but I think misguided.
Right.
And
right.
the other
but
thing...
It's not even the most effective intervention, right? What they're doing.
And what they need to understand, from my point of view, is that this isn't about them right now.
Right.
It's about the people they claim, and children are people. It's about deciding as government what you want to do. Mm. Yeah, I remember First Nations young people wrote a report with us called Feathers of Hope. We supported these First Nations young people, 100 plus of them, to write a report. And young people from remote communities in very difficult situations whose voices were not and are not usually heard. They wrote a report. It was an amazing report. It found its way into the Truth and Reconciliation final report and into the TRC's Bentwood box, which was a huge honor at a ceremony in Edmonton. But these young people went to meet the then conservative Minister of Indigenous Affairs federally, and they were bringing the report. And they have this meeting. It's kind of tense, and the young people are nervous meeting the minister. And the first thing that the minister asked them is, okay, how much money do you want?
Oh, geez.
And the young people actually were saying, "What? We don't want any money."
Right.
The problem is we don't know what to do. Mm. We don't think you know what to do.
Right.
We think there's a huge problem, and we need you and decision makers and our leadership to get together with First Nations young people like us and figure out what we could do together to solve the problems in our communities. Mm. Then we can decide how we're going to do that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be about money.
Right.
But we don't know what to do. And this government is not yet ready to have the brave conversation about what is it we can do together with all of our partners, with all levels of government. What do we want for children in this province? Mm. What is our attitude to children and parents and families? And what do we want to do with those who don't have a level playing field or who aren't doing well? Mm. Then this government can decide how we're going to do that.
Yeah.
And you don't need to start with money, but that's where this government's at. And no conversation about change is going to go anywhere beginning with a discussion of money.
Yeah, you don't start with the bill, you start
with
the menu.
No, I can't tell you how many meetings. The previous government did it too sometimes, and we had to say to them when young people were going to have those meetings with them, you cannot start this meeting with "we have no money."
Right.
Because you cannot think creatively about change by having a conversation that way.
Well, and it's also not true because there is money. It's a matter of what you choose to spend it on.
Obviously, right? And it's you know, as a child advocate, I guess now I can think that way. But as a child advocate, I didn't want to get in that conversation about do we have money, because I do think, you know, if I used when you use that example of if the CN Tower fell down today and it costs $1 billion to put it back up, we'll find the money.
Yeah.
Well, it's not going to fall down tomorrow. Yeah. So let's use that money to figure out what we're going to do for children.
Well, this is it. And if any of these ministers had a seriously ill child, would they find the money? Or would they say, "No, I can't afford it. Sorry, Timmy. You're just going to have to die or suffer." You know, they probably not. So why are they inflicting that on so many other parents?
But that's where I think a bigger conversation has to happen, because I think, and I wish we could get there instead of just talking about money, is what do we expect? Because I believe there will be some listeners and some in this government that say, "You know what? No. If it's my child, I'll figure out how to take care of my child." Mm. And when parents have children, it's their responsibility. Mm. They chose to have, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. They chose to have that child, and so they better take care of that child. Mm. It's kind of that up from your bootstraps approach. And I think it's underneath a lot of things that happen, but it's never said because we often say, oh, no, we want to be the village that takes care of the child. Mm-hmm. But I don't think necessarily all of Ontario believes that.
Interesting. And then especially—
and I think we should surface that.
Sure. And especially for kids in care, who their parents are probably out of the picture, right? Then,
right.
Then they literally are actually the responsibility of the government.
Absolutely. And they live in a system that horrific describes it.
Yeah.
Even for those who are doing well, is difficult, incredibly difficult to live within. All children come into those systems with carrying baggage, emotional baggage, because there's nothing that they did to come into that system.
Right.
But it's circumstances they lived within that brought them to a court decision to come into care. So they come in with this emotional baggage, and no child leaves that system without increased emotional baggage to carry. None. It doesn't matter how great they've had it in the system, and very few are lucky enough to have it that great. So that's that's on us.
Why is that not a requirement, though, of that decision to bring a kid into care by the government? Because it would be the government who makes that decision at some level. Why is it not a requirement that there be better, tighter checks and balances, that there be services associated with that? If they're choosing to be that kid's parent, the government, why are they not choosing to parent them well?
One of the struggles that we had consistently in Ontario with child welfare was to have the government take responsibility for the systems that are providing care to these young people.
Right.
We did it because it was our mandate in the way you suggested, which is these children are actually by law your responsibility,
right,
government. And actually the ministry used to challenge us and say, no, they're the responsibility of the 47 different children's aid societies we created. And actually they were wrong. Over and over again, they were wrong that the Child and Youth Family Services Act then and now clearly says it's the province,
right,
that is responsible for these children. But government tended to offload,
right,
that responsibility to children's aid societies because they don't want to deal with it. Because it seems overwhelming to government to answer that question. Well,
to be responsible.
Be responsible. Yeah. And what do you want us to do with that? Right.
Right.
We're responsible for providing loving, caring homes for these young people. We're responsible for wrapping our arms around them while they're on that metaphoric bridge and telling them they're going to be okay and believing in them. And I railed against this, and I'm going to hear it again. I'm sure we're going to hear it, that the state cannot be a parent. Child welfare, children's aid societies are no place for a child to grow up in. I've heard ministers say that. This minister, too. And I get what they're trying to say, which is if we can support their families to caring for them, that's better than ripping them out of their families.
Sure.
Sometimes, but not always.
Right.
And so the minister and the people responsible for the care and love of the children they have to bring into care are saying our homes are nowhere that any children should be living in.
Right.
Absolutely wrong.
Right.
Because we can do this. And if that's how you feel, minister, step aside.
Yeah.
Because this is a child you're talking about, a child you're responsible for. And if you've given up on them and given up on your ability to provide for them, you need to find somebody who is not ready to throw in the towel.
Yeah.
Because there are thousands, and there are always going to be 10 to 15,000 young people in that situation in this province.
Yeah.
We cannot give up on them. And frankly, the reason I'm so passionate about it is because I've spent years knowing them and knowing that, you know, they're not incredible people. I know people like to say, oh my goodness, imagine the courage. And yes, it's true, but they're everyday people.
Yeah.
And they're as capable. They have as much hope and opportunity if we can provide it to them as anybody else. And they can do remarkable things. And yes, they are examples to all of us of what can be overcome, for sure. But they're just like me and you.
Yeah.
And that's where we can take, and where I take my inspiration from, because look at what they can do. That means I can do it too.
Right.
And we cannot give up on them, and we cannot throw them away, especially when we talked early on, which is so important for us and with these kids in, who we're all responsible for, to say to them, we believe in you. We believe in you. It's why when we finally had tuition relief for every former Crown Ward or Crown Ward youth in care, because what I thought when we finally got that and pushed for that, it's been taken back, clawed back by this government. But the important thing of saying, when we had that, saying to children who were brought into care is, you know what, we're giving you free tuition. You know why? Because we believe you can do it. Mm. We believe that you're going to go to university or college. This is a huge thing to say to a child who comes in with all this baggage and doesn't believe that they can.
Well, and again, that's a smart economic investment, because then instead of falling into a system, you know, that too many kids post-care or who have aged out of care especially do, mental health problems, justice system, whatever, higher rates across the board, instead they're going to go to college, and instead maybe they're going to prepare for a job, and instead maybe they're going to become a different type of member of society. Mm-hmm. So it's a smart economic investment.
Of course.
Now, who's doing this well? Have you seen examples? Does this system work better anywhere else?
The child welfare system?
The child welfare system, but also the child advocacy system. Do any governments do a good job, or any societies do a good job?
Well, I'm going to say this, and it's obvious. I'm not blowing smoke, but we in Ontario had probably the exemplary model of child advocacy, perhaps globally, or certainly won awards and are recognized and still being replicated. So I'm going to Japan in a few months to do a tour to help them create a child advocacy system based on what we had developed in Ontario. So I thought we were doing that well. In terms of child welfare, I've been asked that a lot, even by governments as well. And they're saying, well, where's a child welfare system that's working? Hmm. And you know what? In liberal democratic societies like ours, there isn't. And across Canada, there isn't a child welfare system that has better results than what we do, that doesn't have children move from home to home, that has their own version of foster care drift, they call, or problems with leaving kids in families or taking kids out and then not doing well in systems. And so there isn't a system, but that's my point, actually. Mm. And when a minister thinks they had me there, aha, well then how can you be so critical of us? Well, I can, because if all the systems that are basically the same are all having the same results, then don't we have to think about how to do this differently? Because there's nowhere that it's working. And everybody knows it. It's not a secret. So how can we do this differently? And here's where I see some hope on the horizon. We're federally, if we'll see what happens in the next federal election and what the next government decides to, but we have passed legislation that allows First Nations to have control of their own child welfare. Mm-hmm. Huge setup, because it doesn't include financial resources, legally, the financial resources to do what's necessary. But what's hopeful to me, if we can support First Nations communities to use their own cultural worldview, which is a different way of seeing the world than people like me and people who live in liberal democratic societies, they have a different way of understanding the world, to understanding children in their culture. And I couldn't even begin to explain it, but I remember a chief telling me, a chief from BC telling me that when a child is born in his community, they have a ceremony where the community adopts the child. Mm. Right at birth, they have a ceremony. And it's not the parent's child, it's the community's child. And in a funny sort of way, back over history, they didn't need a child protection system because the community was actually that village, you know. The community was responsible for the well-being of that child and that family. Mm. And so using that world view, First Nations, that First Nation, could create a child welfare system that actually wasn't a child protection system. Mm. And where the hope lies for me is, what would they create? And what could we replicate in our liberal democratic systems that would be completely different than what we have? It's going to be really tough for us to think of anything but a variation on a theme. Now, I know the minister recently has said even though everybody knew they had plans for child welfare and were just waiting for the shoe to drop, the minister has said, I'm going to consult with the people. I'm going to have a online consultation like we did with the sex ed curriculum. I'm going to go and meet service providers. I hope meet young people or young people from care. So I know there's going to be that consultation, but I also know because, you know, as part of the consultation is framed as an amalgamation table. So I know some of the solution is going to be, well, we'll make smaller, bigger agencies. So there's not 47, there's 12 or something. And there we've modernized child welfare. We're going to have a bigger database. There we've modernized child welfare. I think we need a broader kind of more restorative inquiry in how to get at what the children and families need to protect them and to support them so that kids don't need to come into care. And how do we make that happen? And this broader inquiry should be based in a restorative inquiry process out of Nova Scotia where young people and parents who might be in the system or connected to it lead it. And change happens in real time, meaning that it's not an inquiry that creates a report. It's an inquiry that identifies areas that need change quickly, and we move on it. So we were talking earlier, like it's something simple, but what's the training that is necessary for a child protection worker? Should it be a particular course, which I believe it should, in university that's called child protection, not social work? And what needs to be in that course? How do we teach it? Who can do that? Do that in the next 3 months, move on. In real time, we can make change. What do we do about residential care? You know, in Ontario, it's known, our reports, the coroner's reports, there is no standards of care in residence, none. I mean, there's a standard of how big a room has to be, but there's no standard of how young people should be treated, what kind of food they should eat, what kind of programming, what kind of education, none. This is ridiculous. And we've known that. And we know that. And everybody says we should. Well, get it done. So an inquiry might say, well, okay, that surfaces. Who needs to be around the table? Get that done. 2 months, we have standards of care. That's the kind of consultation process that I believe can create real change and build some kind of consensus in Ontario about what our kids can expect.
Sometimes change most effectively happens from the inside. Have you ever thought about running for a provincial government? You still got some gas in you?
No. Well, you know, one thing that I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Like, I used to talk to people, Ken Dryden, who was a minister. I knew, because I'm old. You wouldn't know this. Maybe you do.
I ran into Ken Dryden once at the airport. Yeah.
I'm old, right? And so when I first met him, I thought, Ken Dryden. He was the minister probably, eh? And I thought, Ken Dryden, Montreal Canadian goalie. Remember, I'm a Montreal fan. I was like, oh my God. And he said, hey, Irwin. And I go, oh, I could not believe that when I was like a kid that Ken Dryden, when I was an adult, would know my name, let alone I could talk to him.
Yeah.
And so I did that awkward thing. Should I ask for a autograph for my son who doesn't know who Ken Dryden is.
So secretly for you.
Oh, Ken Dryden, he's that liberal minister. Well, my son doesn't even know that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But he was a minister. The reason I knew him was I worked with young people who had left Children's Aid System. For 20 years I worked with them. And he had created he created a scholarship for youth leaving care. I didn't actually know how he knew about that. And nobody knew about it, but he would give scholarships out. So I knew him through that. And so I met him. I had met him a number of times. And when I was leaving, being the advocate, I said, oh, Ken, because he was saying, what are you going to do? And I'm going, I'm so tired. And I just need to rest and be with my kids. He said, nah. He said, you know, we think oftentimes when there's a will, there's a way. But actually, Irwin, sometime when there's a way, there's a will. I think you're just out of way. You're not tired. And I thought, wow, I'm going to use that. I'm going to use it for fuel, but I'm going to tell others that when they get tired, especially when you look at climate change and what's happening in the Amazon or Donald Trump or Doug Ford, or you feel like overwhelmed and tired. And we have to find a way. so that we can find the will. Yeah. And I'm interested in that. And so in the future, I think, you know, people have asked me about politics, different parties, and I thought, one, I mansplained too much, your listeners would be well aware. And I don't know, you know, Woody Allen said, I don't know if I'd want to belong to a club that would have me as a member. And I wouldn't be good at party discipline. Mm. I wouldn't. And so I'm not sure that's for me. And it's really hard. I've watched them. Mm. Have a lot of respect for what they have to do, elected officials. So I thought about this idea of legislating the conditions in which love can exist and flourish and what could be done. And so there are, I don't want to say the names of these organizations yet, but there are a couple organizations that saying, you know, we know you want to be with your family. We know you have other things, but any time you can give us, mm-hmm. we'll support you to help the systems think about what is it we can do regardless of what, and this is important to me, regardless of the nonsense that our current government does.
Right.
That's my belief.
Right.
Whatever they do. Yeah. That doesn't mean we can't listen to children in whatever services. Yeah. Whatever they do, it doesn't mean we can't focus our attempts to serve young people on the young person themselves. And how do we create conditions in which those two things can happen, because those are conditions in which respect and love can flourish? And that's what I think I want to focus on, is bring together the organizations, the people, the young people, the parents who want to think through practically what can we do and how do we make change regardless of what this government does. Because as I've said to young people, we're so concerned about our office closing. You know, the decision to close our office is going to be the legacy of this government, one piece of it. But it's not the legacy of the young people or the service providers or staff of my office or young people who are in systems of care. It's not their legacy. And their legacy will last far longer than any decision of a government, because maybe this government won't get elected in 2.5 years. Maybe they will. But at some point, there'll be a new government with new decisions to make. Mm-hmm. Any decision of government, I've learned very clearly, is not permanent. Mm-hmm. But the influence that young people can have on others, the influence that man who wrapped his arms around you, is lasting a lot longer than anything Doug Ford is going to do. Mm-hmm. And so how do we build systems in the meantime that create those kind of lasting legacies for children, and invite Ontarians to, in the future, I'll invite Ontarians to think that through with me and so many other informal child advocates.
Erwin Ullman, it's been such a pleasure having you in. Thank you so much for the advocacy that you do, for your voice in enabling others and young people especially to have a voice.
Well, thank you for what you do. You've given me fuel over the years and inspiration too with your stories and thinking, and as you can tell, I've taken your story and used it as a metaphor. I hope I use it with honor and give you honor for that.
I'm absolutely honored. Thank you so much. That's it. That's my conversation with Erwin Ullman, the former advocate for children and youth in the province of Ontario. If you enjoyed that conversation, I know I sure did. He's such a powerful advocate. Check out some of our other interviews in which we talk to people, sometimes unexpectedly so, some people that maybe you've never heard of. I mean, that's the whole point of the show is exploring the diverse ways in which we all impact the mental health sector and break down stigma. And Erwin's voice in giving young people in particular a platform to share their experiences with the system, the children's aid system, the mental health system, whatever it is. That's one of the most significant ways I've ever heard of somebody really working to break down the stigma in a perhaps unexpected way. So I'm so grateful to Erwin for coming in. Check out some of the other interviews with people that we've talked to over on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to So-Called Normal. Scroll down to the bottom, leave us a star rating, leave us some comments on what you think of the show. That really helps us to spread the word and to break down stigma. We're not only on Apple Podcasts, though, so if you don't have an iPhone or if you don't go on Apple Podcasts, you can head over to Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio. We upload the audio and the video for them on YouTube now as well. You can get all of those links either by Googling So-Called Normal with me, Mark Hennick, or by following me on social media, at Mark Hennick, that's at MarkHennick on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, whatever else. I'm everywhere, so go follow me and you'll get updates on the show, which we do weekly. We release new episodes every single Monday, and we've got lots more to come. So stay tuned. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and we'll talk to you next time on So-Called Normal.